Session number 11307.
Mr. Rubinstein, room 3.
Although the army had passed us within about 3 weeks of our being there, there were a lot of Japs left in the hills on either side of the main road. We were west of the main road, and we made contact with the army, and they said, well, look, we don't want to come into the hills to deal with these people. You continue doing what you can. If you meet anything that you really think significant and we should know about it, well, of course, come and do that. So for about another 3 weeks, we operated to the west of the main road, but by now, with a line of communication going down to the army in Pyinmanar. And towards the end of May 45, it was evident that whoever was coming in our direction had already come. And so we said to the army and to Force 136 back in Calcutta, what now? And they said, go down south to Tangu and help a team called Reindeer. The Japs were in fact massing between Tangu and Pew, west of the main road, and eventually they were going to try and break out east. And Reindeer had a big mileage to try to patrol, and they wanted help. So on the 30th of May, we left Pyinmanar, and on the 3rd of June, we came to Reindeer's headquarters, our team, to make a plan on how to best use the two teams. Reindeer had been a team of Major Dave Britton, Captain Jock Waller, and Sergeant Ron Brierley, all of whom had been in France in their different operations. None of them had worked together before. They had already had a great very considerable success in fighting the Japanese in the roads around Tangu, roads and tracks around Tangu. They had done a lot of damage to the railway and had been fairly significant in affecting the tactical situation on the armies coming to Tangu. Other teams, of course, further to the east still, operating in the Morchi Hills, had also been very significant in this role. But now the task was to keep in touch with these massing Japs and keep the army informed. The day we arrived at Reindeer headquarters, which was the 3rd of June, Dave Britton, who had gone on a patrol in tall grass, was killed. It wasn't a very sensible thing to do. You had to be very careful how you operated with Burmese troops, because you were very obvious. The Burmese really didn't like you to be amongst them, because you didn't understand their language, and if things hotted up, they had to take time looking after you, really. But anyway, Dave was a very brave bloke. He had gone out on a patrol towards the river, and he probably was the only head standing up above this grass, and he was shot in the neck. And the long shot was that I took over Reindeer with Ron Brierley. We detached Livingston and Ken Brown, and they went south of Tangu to a place called Tatcone. And Jock Waller, very bravely, went off on his own with his own radio set. Again, he went, Ken Livingstone had gone northeast, Jock Waller went southwest, and we were in the middle at a place called Tatcone. And altogether, we the three of us were probably covering a length of about 30 miles north to south. We'd each got forces totaling perhaps, we'd each perhaps got 150 people, and they were patrolling out to the east, keeping in touch with the Japanese, who were all the time building up for their breakout. And eventually they broke out, I suppose, July time. And we had been able to tell the army almost exactly what was happening. They got into position on the main road. They told us to look after the river line, so we put our troops, our lads, out onto the river so that any Japanese who were able to break across the road and the big valley in which the road runs and who hadn't been hit by the army as they went, eventually they too came through this tall grass kind of thing to the river bank, and our chaps had let them build rafts and push out into the water, and then they'd open fire on them. In one case they had a boat, and they used to let the boat get filled up with troops and go out into it, and then they'd shoot it, and they'd bring the boat back again and do it again. And I remember at that time the river was a continual, as the river ran, and it was during the monsoon time, it was just full of bodies. For about 3 days it was full of bodies. And just as I speak to you, I'm not quite sure of the numbers, our 500 chaps probably dealt with several thousand, and it was a carnage time. And the Japs were in a pretty low state anyway, because they'd having a rough time of it. Where they thought they were going, I mean, if they'd got past us, they'd run into other guerrilla operations in the Karen Hills called Character. And the few prisoners we took, as I say, in pretty bad state, but they still fought with great tenacity, and they had very simple equipment. Their rifles weren't as sophisticated as our rifles. They really had no communication, but somehow I have the greatest respect, although I had no regard for the Japanese. When you saw a dead German lying about, dead Germans lying about, you looked at them and you thought, these could be our blokes. I felt had no compunctions when I moved about amongst the Japanese. What happened then? Well, it quietened down. The next thing was, are we going to get our arms back from these fairly political flatland Burmans? The people, the chaps in the Kachin Hills, had said that when the Japs went, they hoped that the British would come back, because this is the way they had enjoyed life under the British administration, their father and mother. The flatland Burman had never taken to British rule. Well, they'd taken to it, but they didn't want it. They, Aung San, had worked with the Japanese in 1942 because he thought he would get independence from Burma with them. But in fact, he found an extraordinary thing, the Japs were worse than the Brits. So, yes, we did get all our arms back. We didn't get back the Japanese arms that our chaps had taken, or not a high proportion of them. But that had never been part of the bargain from the outset. The army the British administration tried to take as many of these lads as wanted to into the Burmese army, which was still under, as I say, British administration. But I think a lot just disappeared. And regretfully, Burma has had a very unhappy history ever since. I don't think SOE mucked it up. Burma's a very racial country. I've got sort of, that's in broad detail if you want, that's in broad outline. If anybody wanted more detail, I've got it. We thought that after we'd wound up it would be Malaya, and after that it would be something else and something else. Then of course the atom bomb fell, and we realized that this was the end. It didn't really affect us locally because our war was over anyway. We came out in on the 26th of August. Again, we went through Calcutta and on back to Ceylon. There was the possibility of dropping in on POW camps, British POW camps, with a doctor and two or three chaps, and try to help these people initially before real help could get to them. And I'd have thought that that would have been a wonderful way to have finished it all. But people pointed out that I'd had four operations, and there were other chaps who needed to justify themselves too. So since I'd always been very critical of the way we operational people were treated when we went through Calcutta, we always seemed to be interfering with the staff officer's social life when we went through Calcutta, either on the way in or on the way out. This is a very much a young man's view. When you go in, you're tense, you're taut. When you come out, you're stinking like a stoat, probably, and you reckon the world owes you a living for a little while. And you'd arrive at the headquarters in Calcutta, and as often as not, you found you weren't expected, and you were really, to arrive on a Friday at 8:15 p.m. was a bit thoughtless, and one realized the other people had got a life to lead. And so I used to hit the fire gong, walking around saying, bring out your dead. And this wasn't really appreciated, but they said the lad who had been acting as, supposed to act as the liaison officer for the operational chaps as they went through the headquarters, he caught polio, so I was told, I was asked if I'd go up and do it. So for 3 months, really, from September to the end of the year, they gave me a wonderful house, Tagore's house, on the Hooghly River at Barrackpore. And we only had the bottom floor of it. It still had all the Tagore finery in it. But it was a wonderful house, and here I made it a rule to meet everybody when they came in. I'd meet them at the airport if I could. And for 24 hours, I'd let them feel that the world owed them a living. Then I would gradually try and bring them down to earth for their debriefing. And eventually, onward transmission to wherever they were due to go. We made contact with our cipher girls, who generally we'd never met before. We used to have a super party out at Tagore's house every Sunday lunch. Usually went on a bit later. They would end up with a bonfire around a lake in the evening. It was a good way to end up. And we had people coming back from Borneo, from far into Burma, where the surrender didn't reach for a long time.
You were sceptical about the usefulness or success of your missions in France. What did you feel about that as far as Burma was concerned?
We played... What one tried to do in France, it seemed to me, is give the Frenchman the opportunity to fire a rifle for 2 or 3 days only. He could still feel he'd taken part in the liberation of his country, and I think it was probably important that he should be allowed to do that. In North Burma, in the Shan states, the chaps have a very military background. They're very akin to the Gurkha. I'm sure it gave them satisfaction, but I don't know if it was politically important, and I don't know, and it certainly wasn't strategically important, but it was valuable. I suppose one had knocked off altogether about a couple of hundred Japs, but that wouldn't have stopped Chiang Kai-shek. The fact that we were able to put a police force into the area, I think, was probably a good thing to have done at the time. The second operation, particularly the second part of it, and this build-up to the breakout across the Sitang, that's the valley and the river in the valley, we were doing a task that had to be done. And to that extent, we were an arm of the army. We were doing it better than the army would have done it, I expect, because our chaps were moving in a country they knew and understood. We could do it without, if we'd had to patrol. It would have been, I think, an onerous task. They could have done it, but quite an onerous task for the army. But honestly, the army had said, look, we've done our bloody job. We've driven down to Rangoon. Here's an opportunity for your blokes to show what they can do and keep in touch with what is happening in the jungle. And as it begins to build up, we'll come and help you. Now, that was a real role for the time. I'm not saying it won the war, but it was a real role. And was, I know, satisfying to the young Burmese, and was satisfying to us. Of the two lads who jumped in with me, one ended up as editor of the Rangoon Daily Mirror, which was the leading English language newspaper, and the local leader in Reindeer ended up as Minister of Education. They're both dead now, because Burmans die a bit earlier than we do.
You were talking about the different attitudes of the hill tribes or hill peoples as compared with the Burmans towards British rule. What typically would each of the two sides say to you about British rule, if anything?
Well, naturally we're asked what the Brits were going to do at the end of the war. And I feel it was the only bit of double dealing that I did. I mean, I can't really say that I was told, but I think I was told to tell the Kachins that Burma would probably remain under British rule. And one was, I think, told to tell the flatland Burman that the British would be prepared to negotiate and probably Burma would get its independence. It didn't worry the hillman too much, because he would hold up his sword, which he called a da, and said, before you came, we used to look after ourselves with this. You told us that this wasn't quite sporting. You've anyway stopped the commercial oppression that we suffered under a bit from our contacts with the flatland people, so there hasn't been the need to chop them. But if you go, we'll go back to the old ways. And of course, you know, they've done it pretty well with the Golden Triangle. We used to see poppies growing, and they showed me how to gather opium. Well, it wasn't farmed, but they showed me how to gather it, and they all smoked it. But I imagine it was like arsenic in South America. They got a resistance to it, and it was just part of their lives.
Cocaine in South America?
No, I was thinking of arsenic. I mean, they chew arsenic down there.
Did you try it?
No.
On something rather different, you were telling me earlier, off the record, about the formation of the Special Forces Club after the war.
Yeah.
Perhaps you'd like to say something about what you know of that and how you participated in that on the record.
Okay. There was a house in Knightsbridge called the White Eagle Club, taken over by the Poles. And this must have been a little bit of Poland in London for the chaps when they were on leave. Nothing to do with SOE at all. However, at the end of the war, Sir Colin Gubbins was head of SOE, was anxious that there should be a regimental association and also a benevolent fund. Now, the Poles must have found they'd got this fairly expensive lease on this house in Knightsbridge, and what were they going to do with it now that peace had come, and I suppose the Polish community was beginning to find itself in other respects. It didn't want a military club, perhaps, anymore. So there was a coming together, and Special Forces was able to form a club, and it took over the lease of this house in Knightsbridge. And particularly for young lads like me coming back from the Far East, knowing that we'd got to go and be students in a little while, it was a great place to let one's hair down gradually. I mean, I'll talk today's prices, but when we first came back, we had quite a lot of rank on our shoulder. We were quite well paid. We'd probably spend the equivalent of £50 a night in there. But we all knew we'd got to be students on a further education and training grant. And come September, we'd be in there spending £5 a night. Now, divide those figures by 10, and you'll get an idea of the prices in those days. But I have maintained very close friendship with Livingstone, who I was with in Burma. He was a Rhodes Scholar in South Africa, but became a civil engineer and had a very international career, but gradually his centre of gravity came to Britain, and so he and his wife and his family, we're all godparents to one another and so on. And he and Ron Browley, who's had a magnificent post-war career, OBE, JP, one's individual friendships have tended to keep one in touch with Special Forces Club. And then when I was retired, they said, it's about time you did some work for us. So I've been on the committee for the last 3 years, and this last year I'm chairman of the committee. And what it has led me to realize is that how important the work of SOE was to the European countries in which it was carried out. After all, for 3 or 4 years it was the only thing that was happening in that country. Seen from the British point of view, it was one small part of a total war effort. The result of this is that many continentals wish to have meetings, important meetings to them. And this, we're only a social club at one level. We've got two roles. The charter of Special Forces Club is, first of all, to try and keep the spirit of internationalism and friendship alive, and secondly, it's to run a club. It's been very difficult on club finances to try to support the first role in the way one should. It has always seemed to us that funds to support reunion type activity, and I mean reunion in a deeper sense than merely having a social get together, have always been much more freely available in some of the smaller European northwest European countries than have been available to us. We've only had sort of club money, but recently we've had a very generous donation, actually from Paul Getty, and a fund has been established which will enable us to perhaps play a more fitting role in responding to calls for representation from the United Kingdom. If meetings are held within 1,000 miles of the UK, these people get sad if there isn't a representation from the United Kingdom, which of course there ought to be. Yet who's going to pay for it? And one has seen, just because sitting at the centre of Special Forces Club at the moment, I'm aware of these pressures, and I see how important the club is to many European nations beyond its importance within the UK.
You were also telling me about a visit which the Special Forces people paid to the United States, and where you learnt about the importance which the CIA place on the JEDBRA experience.
Well, again, the OSS, so far as I know, had two fairly successful overseas roles. One was in North Burma with the Kachins, interestingly. I just can't remember the reference. They called it Special Force Number so and so. I just can't remember. And the other really was the JEDBRAs. Now, here we trained 100 young, 100 Americans in clandestine warfare, use of explosives, silent killing, the Sykes-Fairbairn method of handling handguns and small arms. And this became the fundamental, this was the first sort of, curriculum was picked up particularly by a chap called Aaron Bank, who was one of the JEDs, and who later went on to become regarded. He worked in China with other of the American JEDs. So I should have said perhaps earlier that they had three operations and three successful overseas operations. North Burma with the Kachins, the JEDBRAs in Europe, and then the JEDBRAs who went out to work in China. Aaron Bank was one of those, and he went on to found American Special Forces and is regarded today as a sort of father of American Special Forces. So, yes, I do think that our training was successful and that they recognized it as such.
Now, going back to when you were doing the patrols on the western side of the Sitang Valley to prevent the Japanese crossing, I think one thing that you forgot to mention was how the Japanese used to make raids on the Burmese villages for rice.
Yes, they did. And it was our job to try to prevent this. And with great bravery, the Burmese accepted into their villages a contrived signal pistol which would consist of two or three bamboo tubes, each with a very cartridge in the base, and from our skill with explosives we knew how to join these together with a fuse and a match, so that if the Burmese wished, they could fire this pistol and up would go the red and the green or whatever it was flares. The bamboo would burst, so we arranged it to be able to be stuck in the ground so that it was light and retire type of firework. and we had lookouts all night waiting for these lights to go up, and we would, from the bearing and the colour, we would know which village was being approached. And we had laid on with the Royal Artillery, because by now we were working closely with the army, we had laid on with the Royal Artillery that they would be ready to fire on these villages with predicted fire when the lights went up. And if you think that the Burmese were bringing fire down on their own villages, it was a very brave thing to do. What I also didn't tell you is that the Burmese were claiming so many casualties amongst the Japanese that one time I began to question their veracity, whereupon for a short period I was presented with little parcels of green leaves wrapped up with bamboo string. When I opened these, I found they were ears, and it was pointed out to me that they were all right ears. I stood this for a few days and then said I'd accept their figures.